From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. African Americans living free in Baltimore before the Civil War were constantly testing whether the law and courts saw them as citizens with rights to be respected. In a new book, Johns Hopkins professor Martha Jones argues that free blacks of Baltimore shaped the idea of birthright citizenship that made it into the U.S. Constitution, and that their struggle still carries meaning for today's immigrants.
People had been permitted to labor in this country, to build families, communities, vocations, and yet they lived with a profound uncertainty about whether they would be permitted to stay, whether they had rights under the law.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. 150 years ago this month, the 14th Amendment, which guaranteed citizenship and equal protection of the laws to all men born or naturalized in the United States, regardless of race, became part of the U.S. Constitution. It took 2 years from passage by Congress for three-fourths of the states to ratify the 14th Amendment, but the ideals it codified had been forged for decades, long before the states fought a bloody civil war over them. Martha S. Jones, professor of history at Johns Hopkins and Society of Black Alumni presidential professor there, argues these concepts of what it means to be a citizen were largely shaped by free blacks, especially free blacks in Baltimore. Jones has just published a book laying out this history. It's titled Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. And Martha Jones is with me here in the studio. Welcome back to On the Record.
Thanks for having me back.
Birthright citizen seems like a familiar phrase. What does it mean exactly?
It means in the United States that our citizenship is derived from our place of birth, first and foremost. Anyone born on U.S. soil, regardless of their parents' nationality or their parents' place of birth, regardless of where they may go, what culture or language they might speak, they are a citizen of the United States. And this is a new concept.
When?
In 1868, by virtue of the U.S. Constitution, the 14th Amendment will make birthright the rule of law in the United States. But as I explain in Birthright Citizens, this is a long-standing sort of claim, one made first and foremost by former slaves who are looking to define their place and their relationship to the nation.
Because the U.S. Constitution from the get-go didn't really define who was a citizen.
No, the Constitution doesn't. It mentions citizens here and there. Former slaves read the Constitution very carefully, and they light on one passage that might be familiar, and it is that the president must be a natural-born citizen of the United States. So they say, hey, if the president is a natural-born citizen, there must be such a thing, and why aren't we natural-born citizens? That is, people born in the U.S., why aren't we also citizens?
I have always heard that before the Civil War, more free blacks lived in Baltimore than in any other city. But I assume that the main story and main impact on history was the thousands more enslaved blacks throughout the South. You argue that free blacks shaped what citizenship means for all of us.
Yes. And while enslaved people certainly have a political life, it is not one that can manifest in newspapers or political conventions or rallies or speeches from the podium. Free African Americans do have that opportunity. And in cities like New York and Philadelphia, but also importantly in Baltimore, there is, after the American Revolution, the emergence of an important African American public culture in which these ideas take hold and are really developed.
A picture emerges in your book of a big cloud hanging over Baltimore's free blacks year after year, and that was the vague threat that they would be forced to leave the U.S., deported.
Yes, and this was one of the surprises for me in researching this book. When I thought of citizenship initially, I thought about political rights, the right to vote. But what I discovered is that free African Americans in Baltimore, first and foremost, are looking for citizenship, looking to citizenship as a way to resist the pressure to leave Maryland and to leave the country. This comes by way of colonization societies. These are white-led organizations who anticipate the end of slavery but cannot anticipate or condone a future that includes African Americans as part of the body politic. Their solution is to facilitate the leaving of African Americans from cities like Baltimore to West Africa, to Canada, and to the Caribbean. And African Americans in Baltimore feel that pressure while they are witness to, in the 1830s, the removal of Native people from the southeastern United States, what we call Indian removal in the Trail of Tears. And this, I think, in a sense, assures them that the colonizationist view, the view that they too should be removed from the United States, is not simply a threat or an imagined future, that it might actually be the case that the state of Maryland might organize itself to put them out. And so they look to citizenship with the hope that if they can make the case that they are citizens, that they can resist these efforts to remove them.
Maryland's leaders were more intense about colonization than many other states.
And that's what makes Baltimore such an important place for studying the question of citizenship, because while colonization has moments in other places, it takes a hold in Maryland and in Baltimore, so much so that the state legislature appropriates funds to support this movement, and some of the people we associate with the leadership of colonization across the 19th century, like John Latrobe, are themselves Baltimoreans. Baltimore's port is a site from which ships leave out for Liberia, and Maryland founds its own colony in West Africa called Maryland in Liberia, to which it aspires to remove former slaves from the state. That's a lot of pressure.
And someone I'd never heard of, the brother of Supreme Court Justice Roger Taney, Octavius Taney, a state senator, proposed pretty tough deportation measures.
Yeah, it's something that I came to call radical colonization. If most colonizationists hoped to achieve their goals by coercion and encouragements, Octavius Taney has another view, and his view is that the state should really draw a hard line, bar free people of color from the state, and appropriate state funds to facilitate the wholesale removal of African Americans. He's proposing this statute in the 1820s, and while he will pass away and no longer be in Annapolis, his ideas will catch on there and be proposed again and again up until the eve of the Civil War. So radical colonization is a fact in the state of Maryland and, again, reinforces African American sense that they are really at risk for being removed.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Johns Hopkins history professor Martha S. Jones about her new book, Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. You present such rich detail about how free blacks in Baltimore behaved as citizens, even when the law didn't want them to. And one way you help us understand is through the Hackett family, telling us about the Hackett family, particularly George Hackett. Tell us about them.
So the Hacketts were really a gift from the archive because they appear again and again in the records of the state of Maryland. We begin with Charles Hackett, who's born a free man in the 18th century here in Baltimore. He is a church activist, building some of the first Black Methodist churches. He is a political activist, organizing in connection with free African Americans in Philadelphia and New York. He is a newspaper agent here selling Freedom's Journal, which is the first African American newspaper published in the United States beginning in 1827. And in this household, there is important talk about the rights of free people of color. Charles Hackett is old enough to remember when Black men actually voted in the state of Maryland at the end of the 18th century and is witness to the writing of a new state constitution that inserts the word white for the first time and makes that a qualification for voting. So out of this family is born Charles's son, George, and we follow George over the course of his long and very active life. He begins as a young, aspiring entrepreneur in Baltimore. He has some disappointments. He gets his first legal education, serving as a steward aboard a frigate in the U.S. Navy, the USS Constitution, Old Ironsides. And he's the steward to the Commodore. And during a Pacific tour, learns a great deal about law and the possibilities for men of color, not only in Baltimore and in the Navy, but in places like Havana, Rio de Janeiro, Veracruz in Mexico. So he gets a kind of education, and then we follow him as he comes back to Baltimore to learn what he does with that education.
Well, in 1859, Hackett petitions for insolvency. What was going on then?
So Hackett is, across his life, an entrepreneur. He's a coal agent. So that is to say, he's someone who is servicing local businesses and enterprises and making sure they get their regular coal supply. By 1859, he's got a very distinguished list of folks who owe him debts and have not made good on them. And as a consequence, he can't pay his own. And he winds up in the Baltimore City Courthouse, a place he's quite familiar with, but this time before the Commissioner of Insolvent Debtors, making his application to have his debts forgiven pursuant to state law.
And he is successful. He gets his
debts forgiven. And he is successful. And that's part of the remarkable story of this book, is that we find free African Americans quite regularly in the local courthouse using the state statutes as they are written to further their own lives and interests and to weave themselves into the fabric of a city like Baltimore, even into the fabric of the local courthouse.
Well, one of the things you point out in different of these many cases that you share is the times that Black testimony is heard and believed against white people or the interests of white people, even though state law says that's not supposed to be done.
Yeah, and it was one of the surprises for me. I went in knowing the terms of the state statute, and yet again and again I find cases in which, like Hackett's insolvency petition, where he, in essence, testifies against the interests, the financial interests, of his white creditors and succeeds. The court hears his evidence, countenances it, and grants him the relief, and his debts are forgiven. And so this is remarkable, and it helps us to appreciate the distance between lawmakers in Annapolis who are writing laws and those judges and clerks and lawyers in a city like Baltimore who are implementing them much closer to the ground. There's nothing in the insolvency statute that expressly prohibits Hackett from using it to its full effect. And in Baltimore, the court will cooperate with that and with many others who come in seeking the same relief.
We need to take a short break here. We're speaking with Johns Hopkins history professor Martha S. Jones about the role free blacks in Baltimore played in shaping how we see citizenship. The new book is Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. Lots to cover when we're back, including what do these ideas mean for immigrants today? I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Our guest today is Johns Hopkins history professor Martha S. Jones. She and her colleague Jessica Marie Johnson spoke with us in April about public interest in the syllabus for their graduate course in Black womanhood. But this morning, we're getting a look at Jones' new book, Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America, which lays out ways that free blacks in Baltimore essentially vested themselves with the rights of citizens before the law made that clear. You write about apprenticeships, which in the 19th century were not the positive career-building learning situations that we think of today. What did it mean for a young person to be apprenticed in Baltimore in, say, the 1850s?
First and foremost, it meant a young person either no longer had caregivers, family, parents who were able to attend to their daily needs, or a child came from a family that couldn't afford to care for their daily needs. And in these circumstances, the state's orphan court here in Baltimore facilitates contracts with white indenture holders who agree to provide for the care, the food, the shelter for a child, the clothing of a child, the education and the training of a child in a vocation in exchange for that child's labor.
You use the word exploit to describe the interest of the white indenture holders in the child labor.
Yes, and what we discover in the records of disputes around apprenticeship contracts is how frequently contract holders are said to be exploiting or abusing young people in the course of the contract.
And so you talk about the way free blacks used writs of habeas corpus to basically get these kids out of the clutches of the indenture holders.
Absolutely.
Can you give us a real quick description of what such a writ is? What
the
is
great writ of habeas corpus literally means produce the body. And this is a mechanism by which, once again, free African Americans can command white contract holders to come into the court and to account for the whereabouts of a child or their treatment of a child or insist on the fulfillment of a contract terms.
In 1850, Maryland was debating how to rewrite its constitution, which was 80 years old at that point. Did they manage to clarify the status of free blacks in terms of citizenship?
They aspired to, and it's one of the important and lengthy debates in that constitutional convention. How do we define free people of color? Are they citizens? Are they denizens? Are they aliens? Are they simply persons or residents? And all of these are put on the table in Annapolis as lawmakers debate the Constitution, the new Constitution. And in the end, as I say in the book, they punt. They can't agree. And it tells us something about how thorny a question citizenship is, especially when it has to account for race and ideas about racial difference. Ultimately, the convention will punt and ask the state legislature to figure it out because they can't.
But there comes what seems to be a point of clarity in 1857 when the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, a Marylander named Roger Taney, issues the Dred Scott decision. In a nutshell, what did the Dred Scott decision hold?
No black person can be a citizen of the United States.
Up to that point, did free blacks in Baltimore feel they had been making progress toward citizenship?
I think yes. And one of the things I was able to discover is that Dred Scott doesn't slow them down very much at all. They continue to do the things they had been doing prior to that decision, after the decision.
Such as?
They continue to show up in the local courthouse and make various claims, be it for travel permits or gun permits. insolvency applications or challenges to apprenticeship contracts. They continued to do those things unabated in the city courthouse, even as Roger Taney has said they can no longer use the federal courthouse.
It's Johns Hopkins history professor Martha S. Jones here on The Record on WIPR. We're talking about how free blacks, especially in Baltimore, shaped the ideas about who is a citizen that now apply to all Americans. The book is Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. In the book you touch on, and you've written more about this elsewhere, the parallels between the former slaves in your book and unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. today. Explain that.
I discovered a scene from our early history in which people had been permitted to labor in this country, to build families, communities, vocations. They were permitted to contribute to the prosperity locally, but also nationally. And yet they lived with a kind of uncertainty, a profound uncertainty about whether they would be permitted to stay, whether they had rights under the law. And this began to, as I discovered it, resonate with the circumstances, as I understand them, of immigrants today. People who are in this country, who thrive, build families and communities, who contribute to our prosperity, and yet live under a constant cloud, a question about what their future will be.
As I was reading, especially the early parts of your book, it was almost the inverse that the free blacks you were writing about were claiming, we have been here, we are planted here, we didn't plant ourselves here, that gives us a birthright. And that seemed to me very different from those who are newly arrived.
In my sense, what we have today is a citizenship regime that in part is inspired by the case of former slaves. Birthright citizenship was meant to settle this question. When you are born here, you are a permanent part of this nation. And what we have today is a regime that splits families, separates them. And I remembered those apprenticeship proceedings. I remembered how part of the profound uncertainty of African-American life was the division of families. One of the things that the 14th Amendment aspired to remedy was a regime in which families could be separated, parents from children, because families were recognized to be essential to citizenship. The integrity of families is an essential dimension of citizenship and a building block of the nation. So my reflection today is the solution, if you will, for former slaves is not one, right, that can easily remedy the humanitarian crisis that we confront today. But it is a reminder of the kinds of values around citizenship, the kind of radical creative thinking that we have done in the past about citizenship when we recognize that there are millions of people among us for whom the absence of citizenship is a tremendous injustice.
When you wrote about this in the Washington Post about a year ago, there were some tough comments. One of them, one man, and I say man because the handle was Frequent Flyer Dude, wrote this in part, quote, "The 14th Amendment needs to be repealed. It was instituted for the purpose of doing right for freed slaves and their children. It was not intended for how it is abused today. No other First World nation has this bizarre law on their books," close quote.
The Supreme Court looks at birthright citizenship for the first time in 1898, not with the question of African Americans in mind, but the question of Chinese immigrants in mind. And in that case, at issue is a young man, Wong Kim Ark, who has been born in San Francisco, left the United States to do business in China. And when he returns, custom officials say, no, you can't return. You're not a citizen because your parents are Chinese nationals who are not citizens of the United States. Can't be citizens because Chinese immigrants are barred from citizenship. And the Supreme Court says, no, the 14th Amendment is clear. If you are born in the United States, you are a citizen of the United States. Yes, this is true for former slaves, but not only for former slaves. It is also true for the children of immigrants, even those children who are born of parents who cannot themselves ever become citizens of the United States. So this is an amendment that comes out of the experience of former slaves, but it has been understood to apply much more broadly. And I would suggest that anyone who's born in the United States of whatever origin must recognize that our citizenship is guaranteed to us precisely because of birthright. And before the 14th Amendment, even the citizenship of white Americans was assumed but was not written into law.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
Martha S. Jones is professor of history at Johns Hopkins and Society of Black Alumni presidential professor there. Her book about how free blacks in Baltimore shaped the idea of citizenship that affects us all is Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. At the On the Record page, we have links to the book and to a panel discussion, including Jones. The topic is New Perspectives on Slavery and Freedom in Maryland. It's at 5:30 p.m. next Wednesday, September 26th, at the Maryland Historical Society. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've been with us this morning. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.